Welcome to Pot Academy. I'm Esther Guyton-Fuertes. Rod Stoneman, director of the Houston School of Film and Digital Media at the National University of Ireland, has recently published a book entitled Seeing is Believing: The Politics of the Visual. This book is a personal and analytical account investigating the politics of visual communication. The book explores the complex and reciprocal dynamic between world and image in this most visually mediated society. Everybody knows images can be false or deceptive, but we all live and work in constant denial of this idea and its implications. In a world saturated with media, we act as though we are immune to their effects. Seeing is Believing is an invitation to explore the potential for contemporary forms of artistic practice to create new spaces for active participation in culture and society. Last June, I attended a panel discussion on book launch at the Birkbeck School of Arts. The book was presented by Laura Mulvey, professor of film and media at Birkbeck and director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Moving Image, Stephen Bann, emeritus professor of history of art at the University of Bristol, and Brian Winston, professor of communications and Lincoln Chair at the University of Lincoln. Brian Winston opened a discussion talking about television and the issues around the relationship between the image and reality.
I just want to make a couple of points about the television. There's a very chilling image on page 108, if those of you that have it, which is all these television presenters looking at the screen. I always say to students, just think what happens if the television presenter is looking at the lens and says, over now to number 10, and looks up instead of not looking at all. This is the notion that we're in an environment of a flow of images, which are extremely highly structured, but which, as Barthes says, totally disguises their ideology, their foundations, etc., etc., I think is really critical. And the whole business of how the technology works and how the relationship between the representation and the referent actually operate is, I think, crucial to to any sort of discussion, either aesthetic or political or both or whatever, of this world of the image with which we're trying to deal here. And it seems to me that we've only gone some way towards dealing with that, and that it's works like this which I think are really reflective and speak to a personal experience of this which is so valuable. So that's really the first thing I wanted to say. I'm also minded that, you know, it is interesting that when you find the Barthian image, you can't recognise it from the text, which, of course, is well illustrated by Barthes, isn't it? You know, if you don't have the caption, forget about it, right? In this case, you've only got the caption. You might as well not have the photograph. The photograph, Rod talks about some instances of fakery, but it seems to me the whole language and approach of fakery is completely not beside the point, but not capable, really, of dealing with the complexity of the issue that we're facing. I mean, you know, there's this horrific story of the Peruvian nanny in Miami in 2002. This poor woman was looking after somebody's baby, and they had invested in a cheap, they're called nanny cams, to make sure the child is all right, and she was seen shaking the baby. So the police in Broward County managed to lock her up for 27 months and then bring her to trial. And one expert immediately got on the stand and said, this is a malfunction in the machine. And what really gets me about this is, of course, it's a bloody malfunction in the machine. And of course you could have known it if you weren't some sort of idiot fuzz in Florida. And if she wasn't a Peruvian, right, et cetera, right? I don't have to etch in the rest. But the fact of the matter is that the most chilling remark about that, and why I think these sorts of, I said at the in my comments on the back of the book, you know, this is sort of an apologia sua vita, and indeed for many, all of us in the room perhaps, all our lives. The really chilling effect is the parents and the guy, as I seem to remember, was in the business, right? He was a professional television person. He actually said he thought she had been released improperly because the camera cannot lie, right? I mean, the strength of that tradition and everything else needs to be, in my view, continually examined. And the whole question of, you know, the indexicality I think indexicality is too simple a way of looking at it, the complexity of the image actually isn't addressed at all by the cultural assumptions that we have. The police, in this particular incident, and in general, think about images now, all electronic, all television images, as being, and the technical term in law is simply, silent witnesses. Right? They are silent witnesses. And of course, they are not silent witnesses, as Bill Nichols says somewhere, I think quite correctly. That is to mistake symptom and cause, and to treat the symptom as if it's a cause. But it's done all the time. So one of the things I want to draw your attention to, and I do so haltingly because there's so much else going on here in this book, right? But there is a strand which deals with those sorts of issues about how we culturally and ideologically position the image, which is important. One of the best remarks I've ever heard on a platform was from Herb Schiller. I remember once in New York, 30, 40 years ago, somebody stood up from the audience and accused him of vulgarity. And there was various talk about vulgarity. And Herb looked at them all and said, "There's been a lot of talk this evening about vulgar Marxism. Well, I want you to know I'm an extremely vulgar Marxist, right?" I mean, I'm not quite saying that, but I'm saying that there is something here. Yeah, the God failed, so where's the other God? And it seems to me that this book speaks to those sorts of things. I keep reading things that seem to say that to me all the time, like Tony Judd's book and so on. Where's the God that failed? I think that's particularly true because we have very little from people inside the system which talks at any sort of reasoned level about its limitations. It's very valuable to have voices like Rod's, which is very clear and distinct in this book, which come through and explain what those realities are, how we were on sufferance when we were allowed to do things in the development of television from Channel 4, in Channel 4, especially at its outset, and how we were licensed, really, to pretend that all sorts of things were going on, which in reality were not and are not. And so I personally am extremely grateful that we have this before us. And I certainly totally second all the thoughts that Stephen expressed about how interesting the book is. So maybe the next stage after this is for Rod to start gathering all this stuff up and be taking it and his masterly position on it to some regime less sensitive to copyright issues than ours, so we can also have a digital version.
Laura Mulvey carried on the discussion by looking back at the history of some of the debates around the politics of the image.
I had a lot of thoughts looking at Rod's book. I can't say we come from the same generation because he's quite a bit younger than me. But at the same time, I think I could say quite confidently that he emerged influenced by the kind of intellectual, the same intellectual milieu, the same kind of world, and the same kind of fascination with film. But what I think is I wanted to emphasize is that although there's not much about film in Rod's book, it's much more about the relationship between picture, story, event, history. That fascination with film was something that was really crucial for our generation, also because we saw it as a medium for change. It seemed to us to have a progressive potential that the other kinds of media that we lived with didn't. Now, looking back at it, one sees very much utopian, what Jeanette Michelson said, the utopian aspiration that was associated with film, which she related back to the 1920s, which was being rediscovered during the 1970s. And I think the 1970s was obviously not necessarily such a complex period as, say, Weimar in Germany. But to us, strange though it may seem, we invested our hopes in the way in which our medium could actually change the way in which people saw the world and also change the way in which people represented the world. I think it's perhaps important just to say that this period of the 1970s was also a moment of return to the past, of holding on to the avant-garde experiments of the 1920s, both intellectually and cinematically, you know, theoretically and aesthetically. There was a very conscious return to that period. And I said to Rod that I would mention the journal Screen that we were all quite influenced by or involved with in different ways, Rod very directly, in the 1970s. But if you look at the earliest use of Screen, you see one devoted to Brecht, one issue devoted to the Russian formalism of the 1920s, another to the history of semiotics. And so there's a kind of curving around of what I think of as that lost curve that was dissolved in the crises of the 1930s of the Depression, but more acutely the rise of fascism and the appalling loss of European intellectual continuity through the Nazi persecution, the racism and fascism in the Nazi period. And I want to emphasize this because I have just simultaneously, while reading Rod's book, I've also been reading my friend Miriam Hansen's book called Cinema and Experience, which is a study of Krakauer, Benjamin and Adorno's relationship to the cinema and what the cinema meant to them, not as a thing, but as something that had to be thought through in order to think through modernity and its relationship to modernism. So cinema as an instrument in the sense of thought and social engagement. And I think to a certain extent, cinema seemed a bit like that to us. So as well as our fascination with film, film was also a theoretical instrument at the time.
Stephen Bann continued a discussion talking about the relationship between text and image, and he also analyzed the different ways in which books can deal with images.
When you look, you're always overlooked, for me, and I think that it's a good thought to bear in mind in relation to Rod's book and to the way in which we might approach the use of imagery, which is there. And particularly, I would like to think, in the tradition of making books with images. And that's by no means, let's say, it's not an easy thing. If one looks at the history of producing, at least in, let's say, the post-Second World War period, well, I think there are two examples one could take which seem to be important in this collection. One of them is positive, one of them semi-positive, semi-negative. The first is McLuhan's great book, The Mechanical Bride, published in 1951, which is essentially an examination of American advertising and publicity images, about, you know, 30 or 40 of them altogether. Now, my second instance, and I think this is something which is very relevant to what Rod has been doing, because the mix in some ways, at least of many of the episodes, is very similar, is, of course, Roland Barthes' Mythologies. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, will know that book, which has been republished, translated, and so on and so forth. One of the really interesting things, though, a fascinating thing, and why I call it sort of half negative, half positive, as far as it contributing to this, you know, this kind of tradition, is that, of course, there are no images. And there are no images, partly because of the technical problem at that stage, or with his publisher, of producing a book with images integrated, as a result of which, essays like the great essay on Myth Today, you know, the soldier saluting the French flag, effectively, we take Barthes' word for it. And once a PhD student of mine did a long investigation, finding the photographs he's referring to, eventually I managed to buy the Paris Match, which Barthes had seen at the hairdressers. And, of course, when you look at the Paris Match, it bears very little resemblance to what Barthes said. And the answer to, of course, to the point is that Barthes is precisely talking about a random thing seen at the hairdresser's, something he's not studied but put down, so it doesn't matter. But it does mean that there is a kind of curiously, I suppose the word is asymptotic relationship between text and image in Barthes' work. I mean, Barthes was pursued, I think, throughout his life by the impossibility of getting an adequate visual illustration to his books. Now, so that I'm really saying it's a difficult thing, a very difficult thing to do a book which, at the current state or the contemporary state of technology, can produce the kind of synergic effect that that Rod has done. So that I think it was going to be a very good reading experience for you, those who are on the point of reading it. And what would be contributing to that is not only the great flexibility, obviously, now, which digital printing allows, and which makes it possible to produce a book like this, but also that this is the kind of book which it would have been impossible to produce 50 years ago, and indeed probably 10 years ago, but which we have the pleasure of being able to read today.
The audience present at this discussion had the opportunity to make questions both to the author and the panelists. Some of these questions referred to the technical difficulties of editing a book in which images are a key element.
I mean, actually, the process of putting it together was really quite difficult. Was at the beginning of this year discovering, okay, it's my naivety, but that taking electronic images and thinking that they would work in a book was not at all as simple, and that a high proportion of them may have looked fine on digital screens but didn't have the requisite 300 dpi. And also, and it refers to what Brian was saying, you know, the minefield of copyright and intellectual property. I remember an Indian director called Shahir Kapoor who made the Elizabeth film. It was in a festival, and I was very taken when he said, in India we see the copyright as the right to copy. And I wish that was more true here. And, I mean, there are, you know, glimpses of, as happened with Godard's Histoire de Cinema, being able to use fair comment as a basis to, you know, invoke and play with other material. But, I mean, it touches on, and your thing about making it digitally available. I mean, I'd always sort of thought, if it's not too, you know, arrogant to say so, that the process that I went through is something that's available to everyone, about just, you know, lifting the corner of an image and, in many cases, seeing it crumble as soon as you, you know, go around it and see what's behind it and underneath it. In a smaller scale way, maybe the aspect of the book that I thought would make some kind of little incursion against the confinements and rules of academia was to insert the personal, which, you know, by and large, when you read academic essays or you listen to conference presentations, is absent. And actually, in Laura talked about it, certainly the moment of screen, you know, there was no personal pronoun anywhere to be seen in that. It was a kind of ultra-objectivist discourse that I mean, when they reprinted your film scripts, that was different, Laura, but by and large, yeah, in the articles.
Well, I mean, there's a reason for that, which I think fits in with the time, and I think it was the spirit of the manifesto and the spirit of a kind of collectivity over the individual, so that when screen spoke, it wasn't just, yeah, speaking for Stephen Heath or whoever, it was actually a sense of purpose. And that was very important in the women's movement, of course. So there was a kind of interesting contradiction between the need to speak about the personal while also the need for anonymity, and the two were constantly juggling together. I mean, from my point of view, I never used the first person, partly because I found myself liberated into writing out of feminism and through the women's movement, and so I wanted to speak, as it were, more in the mode of a manifesto than in the mode of either personal opinion or academic knowledge. But what I found, strangely enough, and it puzzles me a bit, is that now I've been forced to start using the first person, and I think it's due to age. That actually I've been forced to think back on things that I did before when I was not speaking personally. Now I have to reflect back, and that mode of reflection actually has introduced the first person. And I think also, you know, there's no longer that sense of a kind of collective spirit of the manifesto. So although you can certainly say there was a kind of asceticism and Puritanism in the screen style, I think it also had a rationale behind it.
I agree with you absolutely about the eye. I think that, and the explanation you gave, I think, is very convincing, that there is now, with those of us of a certain age, a necessity to, as it were, be to double.
Yes.
you can't anymore, as it were, hide behind, if it is hiding behind a certain kind of objectivised discourse, anonymity, yes.
Brian Winston and Rod Stoneman close the discussion with a reflection on the role of technology in social and political change.
The point I would want to insist on is that the technology is not the driver here. You know, it is the social, the political circumstances around the activity. And yes, it's technically possible to do this, stuff that we could never do. I remember when we got VHS tapes at NYU, we thought the master's program, which was enormous, was finished. I can remember we had discussions that, well, people only took only did an MA in the film studies department at NYU because they got to see a lot of movies. But now, if they can go down to what eventually became Blockbusters, why would they bother, right? They could just go and see the movies. So, yes, of course, there are factors involved, and we can do so much more now. And indeed, we can, the falsity of memory, which was extreme in the earliest stages of screen studies. I mean, people remembered things erroneously, didn't they, all the time? Mm-hmm. You know, that is now obviously a thing of the past. And now we can actually start to, as Rod was just saying, that image of, lifting up a corner of, the metaphor of lifting up a corner and looking underneath. We can do that. But there are still very profound reasons built into the social circumstances under which we operate, why there are limits.
But I mean, there's a lot of attention and discussion of the speed of change involved in digital technologies, and whole social revolutions in the Arab world are sometimes referred to, probably because it's flattering to Silicon Valley to say it's Facebook or it's Twitter.
Yes.
But surely these are interacting all the time, and that to say it is the technology that determines, or it is the social context that determines, neither is really sustainable.
Well, it does seem to me that the extra Western examples of the impact of the technology in the instances you mentioned tend to be a trick of the light. The Twitter revolution was first coined by an American, of course, in connection with the Iranian upheavals of the previous revolution. There were exactly 1,500 subscribers of Twitter in Iran at the time. I think there's a great deal of smoke and mirrors goes on about this. And I'm happy to be accused of overstating hostility to it, exactly because of the prevalence of the technological determinist position, the technicist decision position. But I think that, I think there's one aspect of the new technology and the visual which even I would have to admit is indeed revolutionary, and indeed we've been hinting at it, which is that the connectivity between the referent and the image, which was a given of the cultural and political situating of the analog photograph, is now at an end. Now, it'll be a long time before people stop believing in photographs. That was the point of my anecdote about the nanny. Not my anecdote, but the case of the nanny. But slowly that has to disappear. Now, of course, it's perfectly possible to make an argument that people should never have believed that in the first instance. But the change is considerable. There's this wonderful... I collected many years ago now, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I was collecting what I refer to as the Skytex scandals, because Skytex was the first dedicated program for image manipulation. And there were a number of scandals. National Geographic were caught squeezing the pyramids of Giza together because they couldn't get them on the cover. And they promised that they would never mess with the seven ancient wonders of the world again. I've always thought the spot the ball game that newspapers used to run, where they took the ball out of... I always thought that was a very good attack on, the assumed silent witness nature of photography.
Rod Stoneman's book, Seeing is Believing, The Politics of the Visual, is now available on Black Dog Publishing. Please check our website, www.botacademy.org, to listen to the series based on this book, in which Rod Stoneman talks about some of the images that he analyzes in his book.